You're listening to Faith and Fostering, the podcast where people of faith chat about foster care in the Australian context to encourage, edify, and educate others along the journey.
Welcome to another episode of Faith and Fostering. It's Terry with you today, and we have the lovely Stacey from New South Wales joining us. Stacey, thank you so much for agreeing to be on Faith and Fostering.
Thanks for having me.
I've done a little bit of reading and come across some of your research and a lot of your kind of advocacy work in this space. So it's wonderful to have, your presence here and certainly your experience. And I thought we could just start off today by learning a little bit more about you. So how you came into this space and a little bit of what your family looks like now.
Sure. Well, thanks for that, Terry. You might recognize that I have a little bit of an accent. So yes. I'm an immigrant from the United States. I grew up in the US. And when I was a child myself, I think I was in year three at the time, my parents became foster carers for a short amount of time. We had a toddler with us for about a year and a half. And I was really impacted by that experience. Just prior to having him in our care, my father is a registered nurse. And we had for respite a little African-American baby who was one of the babies that was labeled a crack baby. And he was in our care for respite for a short amount of time. And I found out later when I was an adult that that little boy later died because of the kidney complications he had. So there was something always niggling in me about wanting to give back and provide care to children who needed it. I immigrated to Australia in 1994 and began having my own family. I had three biological children at the time, and I started nursing school because I thought this was a great way that I could give back to the community and learn as much as possible. I really enjoyed being a nurse, but I just felt like I still had something more to give. So in 2005, I became an authorized foster carer to a sibling group of two that later became three and later became four.
Oh, wow.
And somewhere in the middle of all of that, I had a surprise pregnancy. So I am now the mother of eight children and two grandchildren.
Incredible.
And the sibling group that's with me, they're beautiful Dungati children. So they're Aboriginal First Nations children. And they've been in my long-term care since they were all very young ages. But each of them was diagnosed with neonatal abstinence syndrome when they were born. And I think that's what's led me down the path that I've gone down. While acquiring all of these children, I was undergoing my my honors degree and commenced my PhD looking at women's experiences of providing long-term care in the Australian foster care system. And from there, my research just followed that path of prenatal substance exposure because I wanted to understand how best to look after the children in my care that I love. And I figured out really quickly that not very many carers knew much about it. So I was well positioned as a nurse and a researcher to start doing that work.
Wow. What are some of the things that enabled that capacity for you? Because obviously just hearing you, you know, talk very calmly through that in my head, I'm thinking, whoa, another baby, four siblings, you know, work. What are some of the things that helped you continue to move forward through that in terms of capacity that you could keep on growing with those adjustments?
That's an interesting question, and it's usually really hard for me to answer because my family all live overseas. So I didn't Yes. have a whole lot of support network around me. But I had a few really key people in my life who I had incidentally met through the church that I was attending at the time. And they are still very supportive of me today. One of them's godmother to all of my children. And she's just a real joy. But I think being organized and being passionate and being driven and, you know, when you wake up every morning and you see those children that you care about so much, I mean, you're reminded every day of why you're doing what you're doing. And I think for me, too, selfishly doing my research and my work is a bit of respite from the children when they're when they are challenging. But it's getting easier because they're all getting older now. So the youngest is in year six, so it makes life a whole lot easier. And there's only five left at home, so that's easier too. The four that came to me through the care system and my youngest biological daughter are all still at home. So And when I say there's only five, some people laugh and go, oh, my five. But for me, that just, it's a relief because there used to be eight. So it is, it gets a bit easier.
Yep. And you do get used to functioning at a certain capacity level, don't you? When there's a lot of kids around and there's work, you, like you say, you have these systems, there's organization, there's passion. And then when the workload starts to shift, you do suddenly realize, oh, actually, I could do a whole lot more. I'm like, I've trained myself to do more.
Yeah, I think, you know, I believe that if you commit to something, you should see it through. And I think one of the things that I've learned over the past couple of decades is that my children are watching me very, very closely. And one of the things that I've had to learn to do is to not push myself too hard, because I don't want them to feel like they have to push themselves. I don't want them to feel like they have to be perfect or high achieving. I want them to be happy. And I think one of the things that I've had to learn over the last couple of decades is to slow down sometimes and remember that there's moments that you need to just rest and relax and take breaks. And so I try really hard to build that stuff in around everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a challenge, but very necessary, isn't it? Otherwise, you end up not being as good for them as you can be without that rest and those rhythms.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so with you sort of kind of coming into the space, I mean, how many years ago was that, Stacey, when you had your first, I think, did you say 2004? Is that right?
2005, yeah, is when I became authorized as a carer. And I took on a two-year-old and his six-month-old sister at the time. And that was a real change. Going from three kids to five kids was a big step. Just like the step from two to three is big, and the step from three to five is really big. And then after that, you lose count. But I think, you know, during that time, I was teaching nursing at the university, and I was working clinically. And I just found that as I talked about my experiences looking after these beautiful children and the frustrations that I ran into, I found a lot of people didn't understand what foster care was all about. A lot of people would say really unhelpful things to me. They would either praise me up and, oh, you're such an angel, that's so wonderful. And then you just think, no, I'm just giving these children what they deserve.
Yeah.
Or you would hear the opposite. Oh, I could never do that to my children. What do you mean you could never do that to your children? Oh, I couldn't take someone else's children and take away from my own. And I had to really become comfortable with the idea that I wasn't taking away from my children, but that I was in fact building into them and helping them to understand that they are their brother's keeper.
Yeah.
And that their brother isn't necessarily blood related. And I think it's made my children, my older children in particular, kinder, more empathetic people. And I'm really fortunate that I've got good relationships with them, and their relationships with their younger foster siblings are very strong, and they're very committed. They would tell you they are one of eight. They wouldn't say they're one of four, and then there's four others. Yeah. One of the things that I found when I did my doctoral research interviewing women who provided care was that it's really difficult for women when they're asked questions about how many kids they have, you know, because you know, I get that, oh, you have eight kids. And then people try to get you to differentiate between them. And they'll say things like, so you had eight kids, you know, and you actually gave birth to eight. And I'm like, is that really the most important point right now?
Yes.
And I don't like differentiating between my children because I love them all equally. And I can say that categorically. So my eldest daughter, who came to me through the system, is older than my youngest biological daughter. Okay. And there was a period of time when those two clashed significantly. Mm-hmm. And I had some unhelpful comments from other people saying, well, you know, blood is thicker than water. You might have to make decisions and, you know, find somewhere else for that child to go. And I was like, how can I do that? I've been her mother longer than I've been a mother to my biological child. I just can't see that. I'm happy to say that we made it through that storm and they're really good friends now that they're older, which is makes the house a much nicer place to live.
Yeah.
But it was a struggle.
Yeah. That I mean, and we can sort of lead into this too, but exactly what you're saying about coming into a new space and then encountering all the things that come with that that you might not even have imagined, like, you know, comments from people asking, oh, I know we certainly got when we had two little sibling set with us. I've got three biological children, but people would say, oh, are they all yours? And I would just say, yes, they are, because it is a really strange question and from complete strangers. And a friend of mine did say to me, remember, you might only answer that stranger once, but your children are hearing how you answer that question over and over again. And that really stuck with me. And so I think, yeah, I was going to ask you a little bit about, you know, other carers that you met when you first sort of came in, because you've definitely become a voice for carers and a support of carers and have done a lot of advocacy work in that space as well. So what took you on that journey?
It was really interesting. So the university that I work for now, Western Sydney University, has a program, a master's program for child and family health nurses. That I used to teach in, and that program's co-badged with Karatani, who are well known for family services for families facing adversity. And their education lead came in to speak to me one day. I was teaching the course Infant Mental Health at the time, and she came in to ask me if I knew anyone who might be able to put together some training for foster carers, because at the time they were running the Connected Carers program in New South Wales, which was the peak organization prior to my Forever Family coming on. And I looked at her and I said, well, what kind of training? And she said, oh, you know, we've got a lot of carers who have babies and children who were exposed to harmful substances in utero. Do you know anything about that? And I just smiled at her and she said, what? And I said, did someone put you up to this? And she said, no. And she said, why? And I said, did you know that I'm a foster carer? And she went, no, I didn't know that. So it kind of started there. So I was asked to put together a workshop, and I put together a two-day workshop, the first day covering what happens prenatally to mom and bub and what happens during the first 12 months after a baby's been substance exposed, and then a second day that looks at the longer-term implications of prenatal substance exposure. And Karatani started flying me all over New South Wales to deliver this training to carers. And it was really humbling because it was an opportunity to share what I had learned. And it was an opportunity to see carers just grow in the moments right in front of me. And it wasn't uncommon, it still isn't uncommon when I have the opportunity to do these workshops for carers to just look at me with tears in their eyes and say, why didn't anybody tell me this before? And I said, I don't know, because the information's there. We really should be getting it out much sooner than we do. And a lot of the longer term implications of prenatal substance exposure start to manifest in late preschool and as children are starting to enter school. And you can have a child who is in a long-term placement, who's very, very stable in the home, and then all of a sudden behaviors start to appear. And because caseworkers don't understand the implications and carers don't understand the implications, when the carer reaches out for help, the caseworkers are like, well, what's changed? Something must have changed in your home. This wouldn't just come out of the blue. And so when carers hear this is what's happening, it gives them some affirmation that, you know, they're not necessarily doing anything wrong, and it makes them really hungry to want more information. And I suppose that's how this journey started for me. And the more carers that I worked with, I just kept in touch. So I run a little Facebook page now and recruit carers all the time for the research that I do, because I'm always running a new research project. I'm a firm believer that the system doesn't listen to people. I've learned that over the years as a carer myself. But they can't reject hard evidence. And the more research we have that demonstrates what carers need and what children need and what's working and what's not, the better informed we will be when it comes to making changes to the system.
That is a really good point. That is actually an avenue of where you can use your voice to advocate, isn't it, through that research and that evidence-based intel, I guess. Very valuable. And what have you seen change, Stacey, since coming into this space more than sort of 10 years ago, much more now? But when you engage with carers now versus when you were engaging with carers then, what are some of the big things that you've seen change, or have you not seen any changes?
No, I've seen some big changes, and it's difficult to know whether or not they're good changes. So one of the changes, obviously, that I've seen over the last 20 years is the decentralization of of care. So when I first started caring, the Department of Communities and Justice was primarily responsible for kids in out-of-home care, and they oversaw all of the carers. And then a number of years later, they decentralized and outsourced to NGOs. And that's had some good benefits for some and some bad benefits for others. So funding for the children goes as packages. And so if a carer is unhappy with their NGO and they want to transfer NGOs, sometimes the NGO won't allow the carer to transfer with the child because the funding follows the child. And so I think that funding model is very flawed.
Okay.
Another thing that I've seen change is the number of children who are in kinship care. And there is a lot of support in the public arena and in discussions and to a degree in the research for the use of kinship care, as it's thought to help maintain the child's connection to family. But I have spoken with a number of families during my last 20 years, and it's not always the best thing. So for some families, you know, there is the person who puts their hand up might feel under pressure to do so. You know, so if you have a situation, for example, where you have sisters and one sister has a substance use issue and the other sister doesn't, and the children of the sister with the substance use issue end up in care and the other sister ends up caring for them, that can create all kinds of really difficult dynamics for that family. So yes, the children might still be connected to the biological family, but there could be resentment between the sisters. It could mean restricted access to family functions. It might be that the sister who put her hand up felt obligated to do so, hasn't had children of her own yet, wonders if she's ever going to get the opportunity because she's busy looking after her sister's kids. So I think that there's been a big shift in the numbers of how many children are in kinship care. But I think sometimes those decisions aren't really made with the children's best interest and the whole family's best interest in mind. I've been very, very fortunate with the children that I have. I have an excellent relationship with their grandparents, and there was a lot of pressure on their grandparents to become kinship carers and take the children. And they have thanked me so many times over the years for being a good carer to the kids and allowing them to be grandparents instead of having to be disciplinarians. So I'm not saying every situation's like that, but I think it's something that should be considered.
Yeah, certainly. And there is, like you say, it's a difficult, often very difficult thing to do. But the more scope there is for healthy relationships with biological family, just the better I think you can move forward with a placement, because you're building trust, I guess, with that family. And it's not straightforward, but it certainly does help the children in the long run, and certainly their stability moving forward as much as possible. So those are tricky things to do, though, and it's lovely to hear, when there's a situation where that family has been able to kind of come along for the journey and find their place and feel included, and also still be able to, engage and have relationships and not feel like this is now, a complete closed door for us.
Yeah, I think the system sometimes makes it feel like there's a competition between carers and parents, and that's not what it's about. It's about trying to find the best way to support and love a child as they grow and develop. And when it works well. And when it doesn't, it can be quite damaging.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, Stacey, we might we'll take a pause there, and when we come back, we'll look into some of the other areas that you have acquired incredible knowledge and experience in over your years.
We hope you enjoyed part one of this Faith in Fostering podcast. You can tune in for part two next week. And in the meantime, let's remember, every child deserves a family.